Over a period of 4 months, Guguletu, Nyanga and Dalft in the Western Cape were terrorised by a violent and cold-blooded gang. Many victims were hijacked, raped and robbed before being brutally killed. Among the victims was an entire family slain in their beds as they slept. When a seasoned investigator was put on the case, he started to make progress almost immediately and soon realised that rather than a highly organised group of criminals, these crimes were being committed by two specific individuals, with the occasional addition of cohorts. Of those two, one would become one of the youngest offenders to receive the longest sentence ever handed down in the Western Cape. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 204, The Serial Crimes of Asanda Baninzi. This episode is sponsored by IntegriSure. I talk about some of the most serious crimes on this podcast, but crimes like smash and grabs and house break-ins happen much more frequently, and accidents happen too. As a podcaster and freelancer, I rely heavily on my laptop and phone. If something happened to them and I wasn't insured, it would be a huge problem. Plus, you'd all definitely be asking where the next episode is. IntegriSure has been operating as one of South Africa's top short-term insurance brokers for almost 30 years. And I know that as I've gotten older, I've definitely felt more of a need to protect what I've built through hard work with a broker that understands me. IntegriSure doesn't just do car and home insurance, though. They also think about the stuff you probably wouldn't even consider until you need it. Road and home assist, advice from experienced brokers, and a range of value-add products like pet insurance. Because somehow, Fluffy always seems to get into it with the neighbor's cat when the budget is already tight. We all try to be intentional about protecting ourselves, and that should definitely apply to your choice in insurance brokers too. Visit www.integrisure.co.za to connect. IntegriSure, car, home and business insurance for the generation that does not take chances. IntegriSure is an authorised financial services provider. True Crime South Africa is an independent podcast and relies on listener support to keep going. There are many ways you can support the podcast. You can check out all of them at truecrimesouthafrica.com. The most impactful way is by joining the Patreon community. Patreon members get free access to TCSA events, exclusive episodes, discounts on my audiobooks, and ad-free episodes. So you don't have to listen to me say this every week. You can join the Patreon community from just $2, around 32 rand a month. And if you aren't big on commitment, not only is there a free 7-day trial, but you can also cancel at any time. New Patreon supporters get a shout out when they join. Listen through to the end for that. Patreon.com/True Crime South Africa. Please. And thank you. The case I'm covering today hovers in a criminal space that's difficult to define. The members of the group who committed many of the crimes with and around the offender in question is referred to as a gang. But it's not a gang, in the true sense of the word. The offender has been called a spree killer and a serial killer. Two very different things. Yet, I don't find that these crimes really fit into either of those two descriptions. In addition, this episode would also look very different if the offender hadn't been one of the only ones who could be legally linked to all of these crimes. This case is one of many that Captain Jonathan Morris writes about in his book with Mike Baer, Confessor Cop. I am on the book festival run right now and seeing both Jonathan and Mike a lot at the festivals, and I'd love their book to get some more traction. So if you're a true crime reader, I highly recommend it. In addition to that book as a resource, I also used a really well-crafted and well-researched article from Savamus, which explores the other offenders involved in these cases and provides more of an overview. So let's get into episode 204, The Serial Crimes of Asanda Baninzi.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information in our show notes.
Asanda Baninzi was born in 1983. His early childhood was relatively uneventful, it appears, up until he was 9 years old, and his father left his mother, and in turn, Asanda, too. And the boy's mother would end up as a single parent for the rest of his childhood. We don't know a lot about Asanda's relationship with his mother, but Jonathan Morris did engage with her during his investigation, and he didn't see any signs that she was anything other than an ordinary mom who'd done her best to raise her son on her own. The next 9 years of Asanda's life would begin to unravel relatively quickly, though, and lead us to the point where we meet him in this episode. He struggled through school, and much to his mother's dismay, abandoned his studies halfway through his matric year. The reason for this soon became clear when his mother started to smell dacha on him and then realized he was also using hard drugs too. Soon, Asanda was spending long periods of time away from the house, and when he did come home, it was usually only to demand money or to steal his mother's valuables to sell. His mother was at her wit's end and had no idea how to save her son from the downward spiral he was on. But she had absolutely no inkling of what was actually happening behind the scenes and how deep into the abyss her son had truly fallen. Asanda claims that everything went downhill for him when he became involved with the wrong group of friends while using drugs. He claimed that he had no idea the men were criminals until he was so far in that there seemed to be no way out. Asanda's new group of friends, who he met in early 2021, included Mtutulezi Nombewu, who was known as Wax, Pumla Pinar, who was Wax's girlfriend, Zolani Dosi, Shadrach Nonchongwana, and Nturu Tsakane. Another man, Gerald Bossman, also moved in and out of the group's orbit occasionally. After joining this group, Asanda took on the nickname Nana. Of the group members, it was Mtutulezi, or Wax, who was in charge. He was in his late 20s and a career criminal. Asanda claimed that he played an almost father-like role to him, and he was soon teaching him all the ways he could make money for drugs. Although this group of men would later be referred to as the Wax Gang, as I looked at the vast majority of the crimes, it seemed clear that from when Asanda joined the group, it was really him and Wax at the helm of it. Wax seemed to take a liking to the young man, perhaps seeing someone he could easily mold into a trusted criminal accomplice. For Asanda's part, as much as he projects having simply unintentionally stumbled into this world of criminality, his actions tell a very different story. As I get into the crimes that were committed here, I want to note that firstly, we have very little information about the victims, as is often the case in situations like this. I will share what I do have. I also want to note that we only really have Asanda Baninzi's version of who did what in these crimes. And while he would place himself at the scene of most of the crimes, he also eventually gave his confession in a manner which he thought minimised his involvement. So, for instance, he wouldn't admit to having actually killed any of the victims, but we don't know that to be the absolute truth. Of course, as he would later discover, the doctrine of common purpose means that his very presence and participation in the crimes made him just as guilty as though he had pulled the trigger. I think it's pretty important to note that the areas affected by these crimes, Guguletu, Nyanga, and Delft, are very high crime areas. The residents of these places are regularly touched by violence and criminal acts in a variety of ways. Very often, Nyanga appears in police stats as the highest station in the province for violent contact crime. A lot of this is due to the deep levels of poverty in these areas, made worse by their distance from any major work centres due to how apartheid special planning specifically placed these areas, designated for black and coloured people at the time, far from city centres. Gangs and criminal groups also spring up when there are vulnerable people to be targeted. Drugs and alcohol abuse are also huge problems which further spur on crime levels. And these areas also do not have access to the resources they need to solve these problems. Even in areas that are generally dangerous, though, the crimes that we're about to follow were shocking to the community and undoubtedly cold-blooded. The first of the crimes we know about in this series occurred on the 20th of June 2001 in Guguletu. While both of these victims survived, they would not be spared violence from the perpetrators, and one victim was raped, which is why they are not named. The crime did establish a modus operandi, though, that would continue on throughout this series with escalation. The male and female victims were driving in their VW minibus on their way home when they stopped at a robot and suddenly found themselves face to face with a gun. Wox and Asanda hijacked the victims and drove around with them for a while as they stole their bank cards and forced their PIN information out of them. Then the two made the male passenger make a horrific decision. They asked him whether they should kill him or rape his girlfriend. The man refused to make the decision, so they locked him in the boot section of the vehicle while they drove, and they raped the female victim in the car. They stripped the vehicle of all valuables they could find and then drove to a cemetery where they raped the victim for a second time, leaving her there. They drove away with the male victim in the vehicle and later randomly pulled over on the side of the road, leaving the man alive to take back control of his vehicle. The victim's bank accounts were emptied out. For the hours after this crime, Asanda and Wox drank alcohol and smoked mandrakes. Then, in the early hours of the 21st of June, they struck again. Muhammad Brandt had been driving his last passenger for the night, Ryan Masetu, home when they were hijacked by Asanda and Wox. Their bodies were found inside the taxi hours later. They had been shot to death, and the taxi as well as their personal belongings had been ransacked. At some point in the next few hours, the pair hijacked, robbed and killed another man, Nibalo Mnisi. His body was found dumped on the side of the road in Nyanga several days later. The ammunition used in all three cases was 7.65s. But in those early days, a connection between the cases was not immediately made. The three cases were split among three different investigating officers and two different police stations. And with their first set of murders committed, the two perpetrators lay low for the next 3 weeks. I mentioned in the introduction to this episode that it's very difficult to classify these crimes as serial or spree. In isolation, they can be classified, and these three events would technically be a spree, although the motivation for spree killings is usually more personal and less about financial gain. It would be fair in this instance to refer to this as a crime spree. But then, the next 3 weeks breaks the period between the murders, and that veers away from the spree definition. It's clear that very few, if any, of these crimes were well planned in advance. If we're talking about types of killers, this pair were certainly disorganized. But just because their victims weren't pre-selected days in advance doesn't mean the murders themselves weren't premeditated. Wax, at least, if not Asanda too, went into each of these crimes knowing that it was very likely someone was going to die. And if they didn't die, they were not going to be unscathed. On the evening of the 21st of July, Wax and Asanda were on their way to a nightclub when they spotted two men parked in a car in a driveway. The men were later identified as Siseko Ngu and his friend Nleba Falteni. The house they were parked in front of was Nleba's, and the men had just returned from a day out and were chatting before Nleba went inside and Siseko went home. But they would not get that far, because within seconds, Wax and Asanda were at their respective car windows, pointing guns at their heads and telling them to open the doors. By this point, Captain Jonathan Morris knew nothing about the crime spree that had happened in Guguletu and Nyanga in June 2001. The night that Nleba and Sisoko were hijacked was Jonathan's birthday, and he'd just been given permission to go home early from his shift to celebrate with his family. He was halfway to his mother's house when he got the call to turn around. Even by this point, Captain Morris had developed a strong reputation, and when Nleba and Siseko's bodies were discovered, the circumstances pointed to something that would require a more seasoned detective. The two young men had been found lying face down on the side of the road with a single bullet wound behind their ears. The bullet caliber was a 7.65, but Morris wouldn't know the significance of that for a while longer. The vehicle the victims had been in was nowhere to be found initially, but it wouldn't be long before patrolling police officers discovered a man in a field in the process of disassembling or chopping the car for parts. He tried to flee, but he was arrested and was soon talking. The man gave two names to the arresting officers, which were passed on to Captain Morris. The names the man knew them by were not their real names, and he knew them as Wax and Nana. In cases like this, the community network becomes vital in providing information, and Morris quickly connected with the local senior police officer, Sergeant Shoke, who was deeply respected in the affected communities and knew the area as well. He knew that if the community members would give anyone information, they would give it to Shoke. If Wax and Asanda had any idea that they were now being hunted by one of the Western Cape's most successful detectives, they didn't appear to care at all, as the very next day, they committed yet another crime. Taxi driver Richard Dankies was driving his passenger, Faith Mwelane, home in Guguletu on the evening of the 22nd of July 2001, when they crossed paths with Wax and Asanda. They locked Richard in the boot of the vehicle and raped Faith. They then drove the two victims to an empty building in Nyanga, where they shot both Faith and Richard in the head. Wax and Asanda stole both cell phones, bank cards, and the vehicle. On the 25th of July, Ntombekaya Matomane and her cousin Stanley Kumalo were sitting in Stanley's vehicle parked in front of Ntombekaya's house in Guguletu when Wax and Asanda hijacked them. They abducted the pair and took them to a field where they shot them. Miraculously, both survived the head wounds, but Ntombekaya was permanently blinded, and she sadly died from the resulting injuries a year later. Stanley survived, but was deeply emotionally scarred by what he'd experienced. By this time, the earlier cases had made their way to Captain Morris by virtue of the similar MO and the caliber of the bullets used. All the victims at this point had been killed with a 7.65 caliber weapon. Community informants had also provided the actual names to match the street nicknames, and Morris knew he was now looking for Asanda Baninzi and Mtutuzeli Nombewu. He visited the parents of both men, and neither had seen their sons in quite some time. Wax's mother said she was glad he was staying away, because whenever he was there, he stole her valuables and he was abusive to her. Morris was able to ascertain that Wax was due to appear in court on a charge of stealing a television, and while he was pretty certain the man wouldn't arrive, he did post officers at the court just in case. Wax didn't show up for his court case. After this most recent spree, there was another pause in the crimes, and a frustrated Morris felt as though he was being played with by these criminals. Then on the 8th of August, they struck again. Sergeant Ayanda Bokweni, who worked at Langebaan Air Force Base, was driving with his girlfriend, Linda Mbambisa, in Yanga, when Wax and Asanda hijacked them. Linda was forced to watch from the car as the two criminals walked Ayanda to the side of the road, made him lie face down, and shot him in the head. They then drove Linda to a separate location where they raped her before killing her and leaving her body in the backyard of a random house for a horrified family to discover the next morning. Ayanda and Linda weren't immediately identified as their IDs and bank cards had been taken. But when Linda didn't return home after the weekend and Ayanda didn't report back for duty, their families found their bodies at Salt River Mortuary, and their cases were linked back to the ongoing spree through the bullets used to kill them. The same night they'd killed Ayanda and Linda, Wax and Asanda committed more crimes. Nomvuyo Mtiki was allegedly known for being an occasional low-level drug seller in the area, and the two criminals arrived at her home that night, pretending to be police officers, banging on the door and telling her to open up. Nomvuyo opened the door, and the pair told her that they wanted Mandrax tablets. She told them she didn't have anything, but they forced their way in, and after ransacking her home and finding no drugs, they stole what money she had and then shot Nomvuyo while her young son sat on the bed nearby. To muffle the sound of the shot, to give them enough time to get away without alerting neighbours, one held her down while the other placed a pillow over her head. She would only be found the next day when her son's cries were heard by the neighbours. Captain Morris had asked the original investigating officers from the first cases to complete their investigations and then hand the dockets over to him. And by the time Nomvuyo was found with the 7.65 caliber gunshot to her head, he had received all the cases and started to visit each of the scenes himself, as well as interviewing all of the family members. He and Sergeant Shoke worked together on these visits, with Shoke interpreting for the family members who were more comfortable speaking in their home languages, which Morris did not speak. As had become their pattern, the criminals went into hibernation again for a few weeks, and then, on the 20th of August, they once again set out with murder on their minds. Vuyo Tati and his girlfriend were driving in Guguletu that night when Wax and Asanda hijacked them. The men had stopped on the side of the road and forced Vuyo to lie face down before shooting him in the back of the head. Up until that point, the men had relied on fear to control most of their female victims when they left them in the car to kill their male companions. This time, though, when Vuyo's girlfriend was left in the vehicle, she managed to flee, undoubtedly escaping death. After discovering that their other victim had fled, Wax and Asunder continued driving in the victim's vehicle. And not far down the road, they spotted two men chasing after a group of teenagers. The two men were armed with guns, and it would turn out that they'd been attacked by the teenagers and had their car stoned, and they were trying to detain the youngsters. One of the men was an undercover police officer, Sergeant Timothy Ndabeni, and the other was his informant, Sydney Molefe. Ndabeni had received an award for exemplary work just months before. Wax and Asunder did not know this as they slowed down and asked the two men if they wanted a lift to catch up with the teenagers. Having left their own vehicle a few blocks back to give chase on foot, the men agreed and got into the vehicle. The teenagers had dispersed, though, and Sergeant Ndabeni started to get a bad feeling about the two men, so he asked them to stop so that he and Sydney could get out. Wax and Asunder did stop, but they were set on getting what they had seen and wanted in the first place, the two 9mm handguns. Ndabeni and Molefe were both shot within seconds of the car being pulled over and dragged out onto the street while the men sped away with their guns. Sergeant Ndabeni survived, but sustained wounds which resulted in paralysis. Sydney Molefe died on the scene. The following day, Wax and Asunder would commit what would be the last crime of their spree. It was all completely different in modus operandi to the other crimes, and it would be perhaps the most terrible of them all. Felicity Adams was a working mom of two girls, 10-year-old Shauna and 16-year-old Alexis. She and her husband Marius lived with their daughters in Delft. Felicity ran a tuck shop in a property across the road from her house. That property was owned by a woman who would later be identified as Wax's aunt. Wax occasionally stayed at the property, but more importantly, he had also built a small structure where he often kept some of the items he'd stolen from his victims, and sometimes he had people chopping the cars he'd stolen in the field beside his aunt's house. Felicity had no idea how vicious of a criminal Wax was, but she knew that he was involved in some dodgy stuff for sure. And she warned him that if he continued to bring stolen items onto the street where she lived, she would call police. Wax laughed her off, but Felicity was serious about ensuring that crime was not being committed in the streets her children lived on. And on the 23rd of August, she did call police. Wax was livid when he heard that his aunt's house, as well as his stash structure, had been raided. Some of the items recovered from the stash area would later be linked back to the victims I've already mentioned. Unfortunately for the police, Wax was still on the run, and the day after the raid, he took his revenge on Felicity Adams. Asunder Beninzi would later claim that he and Wax had gone to the Adams house first that night to scare Felicity into never snitching on him again. But after that, they'd left. And then Wax had changed his mind and decided that Felicity had to die. It would be both revenge and a warning to anyone else who thought they could snitch on him. According to Beninzi, another member of the group had put his hand up to go back to the Adams home. Shadrach Nonchongwana had been an occasional participant in some of their other crimes, Asunder said, and he also owed Wax a debt for drugs he'd supplied him with. So, to repay this debt, Shadrach said he would do what Wax had instructed. Asunder and Shadrach were armed with the 9mm that had been stolen from the undercover cop and his informant in the earlier crime. The men waited until the Adams house had fallen into silence and darkness that night, before breaking in. By the time they left, all four members of the Adams family, including the two children, lay dead in their beds with gunshot wounds to their head. With this crime having been a completely different modus operandi, a different caliber weapon, and in a different area, it is entirely possible that it may never have been linked to this group if things hadn't played out the way they did next. We don't know whether Felicity gave the tip-off to police with her name or anonymously, even though Wax knew it had been her who had called them. So, it's very possible that the link may never have been made. That same night, after Shadrach and Asunder joined back up with Wax, the group carried out three home invasions and stole three vehicles. Thankfully, no further victims were harmed during these crimes. The following night, though, one of the stolen vehicles was spotted with four men inside. Police gave chase, and following an exchange of gunfire, two men were arrested, while two managed to escape. The men were highly intoxicated, and getting anything out of them was incredibly difficult. But Captain Morris would soon get the call to say that one of the men who'd been arrested was Asunder Baninzi. But unfortunately, one of the ones who'd gotten away was Wax. The other man arrested that night with Asunder was Shadrach Nonchungwana. Morris rushed to the station that night, but quickly realized he wasn't going to get anything out of Asunder. And so, instead, he gave instructions for the young man to be allowed to sleep off his stupor, and he'd try again the next day. If you've listened to any of the other cases I've covered where Captain Morris was the investigating officer, and from the title of his book, you'll know that he was known as the Confessor Cop, because he was legendary in his ability to connect with suspects and get them to confess to what they'd done. Morris has told me that he did this by connecting with whatever remained of the humanity of the person he was sitting across the table from. It may be difficult to accept, after all I've told you about what Asunder Baninzi did, that there was truly any humanity left in him. But the really shocking thing is that this young man had only just turned 18. He had been 18 while he was committing all of his crimes, and therefore legally an adult. But as any of us who know an 18-year-old knows, still barely more than a boy. And this was what Captain Morris was banking on. Morris writes in his book about how he would often see the lost boys in even the oldest of male offenders before him. And as a father himself, it was to this lost boy he tried to speak. Morris was going to go into his interview with Asunder with a strategy, and he started by visiting Asunder's mother. The woman was not surprised to hear that her son had been arrested, but she was entirely horrified when Morris shared with her what her son was accused of. I guess, like most parents, it would be very difficult for her to accept that her son had become a cold-blooded killer and rapist. Asunder's mother gave Morris a bar of soap and a clean set of clothes to take with him for her son. He promised to keep her updated, and he left with a heavy heart, knowing that he just irreversibly changed the woman's world. Back at his office, he prepped for his interview with Asunder. He'd purchased a pie and coke and put that on the desk along with the clothes and soap from Asunder's mother. When the young man entered, Morris said absolutely nothing about the crimes. He simply shared that he'd been to visit his mother and asked if Asunder was hungry. The young man devoured the pie and gulped down the drink before being escorted to a bathroom where he could clean up and change clothes. Morris never once heard an accused to have a reason to claim they'd been mistreated, which had resulted in their confession. his kindness, also played another role. It sets the guard of the accused down. By the time he started asking Asanda about the crimes he was accused of, it didn't take much at all for the young man to confess. He did, of course, reduce his own role in the crimes, or at least he thought he did. In each description, he put the gun in someone else's hands, usually Wok's. But he admitted that he was present and part of the robbery elements of the crimes. Morris let him talk. He had read him his rights and done everything by the book. Asanda had agreed to talk to him without legal representation. Morris figured that when he did get a lawyer for trial, he would then learn about the doctrine of common purpose and how deeply he was implicating himself, despite thinking he was reducing his culpability. After Asanda provided this confession, he also pointed out a few places where he knew Wok would sometimes hide out, and police as well as members of the community were asked to keep an eye on these places and report any sightings of the man. Although Morris was grateful that he'd at least caught one of the criminals he sought, he had no doubts that Wok was the mastermind. And if he didn't find the man, he would simply find new recruits and continue with his crimes. Over the next few weeks, Wok became like a phantom to Captain Morris. When Morris wasn't building the case for trial against those already arrested or working one of the many others he was assigned, he had nightmares that he was hunting Wok, and at the critical moments his weapon would fail or something else would prevent him from arresting him. Other nights, his nightmares were filled with violence, and he dreamed about catching the man and unloading his gun into his body, as he'd done to his victims. He was a man obsessed. Sergeant Joke was still working the community hard for tips. And in early September 2001, a tip finally came in. Wok had been spotted going into an informal structure in Guguletu. Police descended and found a huge crowd of community members already surrounding the structure and baying for Wok to come out, while mindful that he was likely armed. For hours, police tried to negotiate with Wok, but he refused to come out. Eventually, they brought in a 4x4 armoured personnel carrier vehicle, also called a Nyala, and rammed down a portion of the structure. As they did, a gunshot rang out. Ntutuzelu Nombewu, Wok, had fired a single bullet into his head, killing himself instantly. Captain Morris was torn in his feeling about this. On one hand, the man would now never face justice. But on the other, his surviving victims, their families, and his future victims would never have to worry about him darkening their door again. Now, Morris could focus on ensuring they had a watertight case against Asanda and the other identified individuals who had been involved in the string of crimes. Wok was no longer his problem. The Guguletu community had dubbed Mtutuzeli Nombewu Satan, and his family had to transport his body well out of the area to bury him, as residents did not want him to be buried among his victims. The sheer number of victims made this case a complex one to bring to trial, and prosecutors had to try to figure out which of the arrested individuals was in fact connected to which of the crimes. With the murder of the Adams family having been so different from the other crimes, and having enough evidence to connect both Asanda Baninzi and Shadrach Nonchingwana to the vicious crime, prosecutors decided to try this case separately and before any of the others to ensure they could keep those two men behind bars. In December 2003, Baninzi and Nonchingwana were found guilty of the murders of Felicity, Marius, Alexis, and Shauna Adams, and sentenced to 4 life sentences each for these crimes. Finally, in April 2004, the rest of the crimes were presented in trial in the Western Cape High Court. Asanda was facing 50 charges, 14 of murder, 3 of attempted murder, 4 of rape, 15 of robbery, 12 of aggravated robbery, 1 of indecent assault, 2 of housebreaking, and 2 for the illegal possession of arms and ammunition. Captain Morris admitted that when he'd heard the evidence of what Asanda had actually done and compared that to his rather sanitized confession, he was shocked at how depraved the young man truly was. Although he said that his crimes had been a result of him getting involved with the wrong crowd and that his use of and addiction to Mandrax had allegedly driven his criminality, Asanda admitted that he had, quote, unlawfully and intentionally committed murders and other crimes, end quote. He said, quote, I'm very ashamed of what I've done and deeply regret the pain and suffering that my actions have caused the families and friends of the victims, end quote. By this point, Asanda had clearly realized that regardless of how much he tried to claim he didn't pull the trigger in any of the murders, he was indeed legally guilty of the act of murder through common purpose. And so he pled guilty to all the charges against him. Asanda's lawyer attempted to convince the judge that his client was essentially a lost young man who had gotten pulled down the wrong road and had found himself committing crimes he had no initial intention to commit. The judge was hesitant to accept this, saying that if this was the case, he couldn't understand why the young man would have raped some of the victims, as that act was completely unnecessary to robbery or getting money for drugs. Asanda's lawyer said that he'd been on an escalating treadmill, which had led to actions he himself could not explain. The judge acknowledged that Asanda had shown remorse, but also said, quote, over a period of 9 months, Asanda Baninzi and his friend went on a murderous rampage. Not satisfied with their armed robberies, they repeatedly raped female victims and then cold-bloodedly killed them, end quote. On the 5th of May 2004, Asanda was handed down 19 life sentences, in addition to the 4 he had already been given for the murders of the Adams family members. At that time, it was the longest sentence handed down to any single offender in recorded legal history in the Western Cape. The highest number of life sentences handed down in the whole country, as far as I've been able to determine, is 42, which were handed down to serial rapist Nkosinathi Phakathi. As far as I can tell, Asanda's 19 life sentences remains the highest number handed down in the Western Cape to date, with the closest being serial rapist Sikangele Mki, who was handed down 15 life sentences for his crimes. All of these sentences are, of course, served concurrently, and Baninzi will therefore become eligible for parole after serving 25 years of his sentence. The large number of life sentences, as well as the fact that he was found guilty of killing 2 minors, will undoubtedly be considered at this time. In 2006, Asanda testified in the trial of another of the individuals he had accused of being involved in the crimes. Ntura Takani was charged with 10 counts relating to murder, hijacking, and illegal possession of a firearm and ammunition. Wox's girlfriend at the time of the crimes also testified about 6 of the hijackings she'd had knowledge of, which she knew Takani had also taken part in. The woman claimed in her testimony that she did not know that Wox was a criminal when she first got involved with him, and by the time she realized who he really was, he had her under deep control, and he threatened to kill her and her family if she left him. Takani, as well as Gerald Bosman, who was tried separately for his involvement in a few of the crimes, were both found guilty and handed down several life sentences each. And these trials would end the reign of the so-called Wox Gang. Well, I guess that would depend on who you asked. Around the time that these final trials were happening, people in Guguletu and surrounding communities were reporting a surge in gangs operating in a similar manner to Wox's group. A group calling themselves the Tutsis had been operating in the same area, abducting residents and forcing them to hand over their belongings. Two teenage boys had been abducted by this new gang just meters from where Wox had ended his life, and at the time of reporting, they were still missing. Residents told journalists that although police claimed the Wox gang had been destroyed, they believed it was just reincarnated in a different form. And honestly, they may not be wrong. Cases like this are not at all uncommon, although it is rare for an individual as young as Asanda to commit as many crimes as he did over such a short period of time. The rate of his acceleration into severe criminality and violence is not what we usually see with these individuals. And I think that is what makes this case so distinct. The sheer number of murder victims for such a small group of criminals is also truly devastating. At one point, the Guguletu and younger communities were burying victims every weekend. And the long-lasting effects of the murder of these victims on their families can never truly be fathomed. Muhammad Brandt, Ryan Masetu, Mnimalo Nisi, Neba Faltain, Tiseko Ngu, Richard Dankies, Faith Ngwelani, Ntombekya Matomana, Ayanda Bokweni, Linda Mbambisa, Vuyo Tati, Nomvuyo Mtiki, Sydney Molefe, Felicity Adams, Marius Adams, Shauna Adams, and Alexis Adams. Rest gently. For more victim-focused true crime content, please follow True Crime South Africa on the app you're using to listen right now. I also have another podcast you might like called I Lived Through This. Follow the podcasts on social media platforms for updates on new episodes and other crime-related stuff. If you'd like to support the podcast and grab some True Crime South Africa branded merch, listen up. TCSA has partnered with the SA Criminologist platform, and if you head over to their website now, you can stock up on a wide range of true crime-themed merch, including tumblers, stickers, pens, mugs, and so much more. And if you use the code TCSA at checkout, you'll get a site-wide discount of 10%. Check out the full range of true crime-themed merch at sacriminologist.co.za. And support TCSA while grabbing some truly cool goodies for you or your partner in crime. Shout out to the podcast's new supporters over on Patreon. A huge thank you goes out to Susan and Sunet Lee Faree, Raiden, Rachel, Ngoli, Pumela Adonis Mabande, Carl Heinz von Beitheim, John Easy, Shazia Coop, Carly Ann, Helen Kasten, Candace Gordon, Lida Kruger, Christine Skultz, Joe Murray, Charlize Myberg, Diana, Nadia Sneyman, Liesl Erasmus, Lizanne de Villiers, Kelsey Gonzalez, and Kelly Shawe for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. I'll be back with another episode before you know it. Until then, thank you so much for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.